Hi, it's Lucy and welcome back to another episode of The Real Girls Club, my podcast where I interview women working in the film industry. Today, I'm so excited to say I'm joined by Domi Shi. Domi is a Chinese-Canadian filmmaker, director, writer and storyboard artist at Pixar Animation Studios. In this chat, we talk about what it was like to win her first Academy Award for her short animation film, Bao, her inspiration behind her first feature animation, Turning Red, what kind of things take a long time to do in animation, advice for future filmmakers, and so much more. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy the episode. Hello!
Hi!
Hi, Domi! So nice to meet you.
How do you pronounce your name?
Lucy.
Lucy.
Nice to meet you, Domi. I'm so excited to speak with you today. But how are you doing anyway? How are things with you?
Good. Busy. Yeah.
I'm busy.
Co-directing a new movie at Pixar right now, and it's going to be coming out next summer. So
I think I know which one you're talking about, but we will talk about that later. I'm very excited to speak with you anyway. I'll try not fangirl too much, and I'm sure a lot of people say this to you, but I mean, I grew up watching Pixar films, so to talk to someone that's a filmmaker and an artist at Pixar is definitely, I would say, a dream come true without sounding too gushy. But yeah, I mean, I grew up watching A Bug's Life and Finding Nemo and The Incredibles and Toy Story and, of course, all the more recent ones. You know, just to name a few, because of course Pixar has done so many amazing films. So yeah, it's just, yeah, I feel really grateful that you said yes to my podcast and that I'm able to speak to you. So just wanted to say that and get that out the way first. But yeah, I'd love to just get started talking about your days growing up and what your early influences of art and cinema were, and whether that came from family or friends or elsewhere.
Yeah. I mean, it's so funny. I'm exactly like you. Like, I also grew up watching A Bug's Life and and Incredibles, and Pixar was definitely a huge part of why I wanted to get into animation. So it's kind of surreal to be a part of the studio now that's shaped so much of my childhood and who I was. I mean, I've always loved drawing as a kid. My dad was an art professor back in China, and when we immigrated to Canada when I was 2 years old, he was still like painting and drawing and teaching art, so I was always surrounded by art, and he was kind of like my art teacher growing up in a certain way. So I've always had that interest in drawing, but it was really like animation, anime specifically, Sailor Moon, Pokemon, like that kind of awakened something in me in elementary school, and I started drawing way more after that. The internet kind of like shaped me in a huge way too. You know, back in the 2000s, there was DeviantArt, there was Blogspot. There were all these online communities where I could post art and follow other artists and get like just comment on their work. They could comment on mine. I could ask people for advice. Like, it was where I kind of found my art community, my animation community on the internet. And that's kind of how I discovered animation as like a profession, was because a couple of these artists that I followed online went to animation school, specifically Sheridan College, which was this college outside of Toronto, which is where I grew up, and they had an animation program there. And I convinced my parents that, you know, this is what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. I still didn't, you know anything about animation. I just knew I liked drawing and telling stories with drawing. But I think just following that passion for drawing and sharing drawings and stories with other people has kind of led me into, yeah, this career.
So was there, yeah, there was a specific sort of click moment then where you went, well, this isn't just drawing and doodling. This could actually be my life if I wanted it to be.
I think so. What was it? Well, I don't know. I feel like I couldn't quite think too far into the future. I just had to keep thinking like, okay, what's the next step? Just focus on the next step. So when I was in high school, the next step was, okay, what college do I want to get into? What do I want to study and learn and grow, and where do I want to grow in the next 4 years? And then I'll figure out after college, you know, after that. And that was Sheridan. And then while I was at Sheridan, I discovered storyboarding. And I think that was kind of when it clicked for me. I was like, oh, like, this is actually what I really want to do. Storyboarding, for people who don't know, is you're kind of like drawing the blueprints of a film, of an animated film, sometimes live action as well. Like, you get a script from the director, a couple pages, and then you would actually just draw out what the scenes might look like with all of the acting, camera, staging.
Like a comic book, almost, in a way.
Basically, yeah, it's like a comic book. And that's kind of how animation is created, because it's so expensive to animate and build everything. So you want to, like, test out the story beforehand and put it all up to watch from beginning to end in a really rough version of the film. So that's what storyboard artists do. They kind of just draw out this rough version of the movie. And that's kind of where you can make changes, you can add jokes, add emotion, acting, take out ideas too. It's where you can kind of just iterate and figure out what the movie's going to be. It's in storyboard form. So I just loved that. It just combined everything that I loved, like drawing, like filmmaking, storytelling, problem solving. And when I took that, my first storyboarding class in college, I knew I wanted to do this. So I kind of focused and zeroed in my portfolio the rest of my time at college to really just try to boost my storyboarding chops.
It sounds like you had your dad being from an art background, that you had a supportive background already, since your dad was really into art. Of course, he was going to be like, yeah, go for it, you know, to do with art and everything.
Yeah. My dad and my mom were both really supportive. They were very, very crucial and pivotal in me kind of landing where I am today. But it's interesting. So both my parents come from academia. So my dad came from art and my mom came from, like, writing and education. You know, she got a PhD in education. Wow. And it's so funny because, like, growing up in our three-person household, like, the hierarchy was always, like, my mom, my dad, and me. And I was always, like, so, like, indignant. Like, why am I at the bottom? And my dad, it's because you don't have a bachelor's in applied arts. And I was like, what?
You need a degree.
But yeah, so my dad would kind of be encouraging the art and drawing side of my growing up, and my mom would be encouraging my writing. And I remember as a kid, you know, every movie I watched, every book I read, she'd like force me to do like a report, like to write a report on,
like,
it.
A review or something.
A review. She'd encourage me to keep writing short stories.
That's great.
She'd like grade me. So yeah, my parents were supportive, but they were also very like hardcore. Like I'd go to life drawing classes with my dad, and then at home he'd like make me put out all of my drawings in a row one by one, and he would like, critique them.
You owe a lot to them then.
I know. So they were very supportive, but it was also like a mixture of tough love as well.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like they, you know, definitely, like, you come out of school and then you're kind of going into homeschool in a sort of way. But I mean, great to foster all those, like, passions.
Yeah, I mean, I owe a lot to them, but also I just naturally loved drawing as well. I think if they just forced me to draw and to write,
that would be different.
I didn't have an interest in it. I don't think I would have gotten into it, but I think because I naturally did love it as well, it really helped me. Kind of motivated me to kind of learn on my own as well. And that's, you know, I had the internet. I could like pull up Photoshop tutorials or like Flash tutorials, and I would just learn on my own as well. Like, I felt that motivation as well.
So yeah, you said you went to Sheridan College, and then following your studies there, you applied for an internship at Pixar. But I read somewhere, hope this is correct, that it was actually your second attempt, and it was your dad that was the one that encouraged you to apply again. Can you tell me a bit more about that, and like the transition from student to intern, and sort of not like backing down and losing hope, even though maybe you got, you know, a few rejections here and there?
Yeah, man. Like, once you're in college, it is like you finally feel like you found your people. You're like, oh my gosh, I'm in animation school. Suddenly I'm not the only kid that loves anime. Everybody loves anime. Everybody's watching, you know, everything. And you just feel like you found your community. But at the same time, you feel like the pressure is on too. Like, you went from like a big fish in a small pond, and all of a sudden you're surrounded by super talented, super passionate, driven people just like yourself. And there was definitely this pressure at school to like get a good internship, to get a job afterwards as well. And I remember this was third year at Sheridan, and it was just a really, really tough year in general, because that was at third year at Sheridan College, you do a group film project. And I don't know if they still do it like this, but it's pretty crazy. Like, they basically pull names out of a hat.
Okay.
And assign students to like in groups of like 10.
Mm-hmm.
And just like kind of say like, go make a film without any other mandates, or like you have like a professor as a mentor, but you know, there's no, you kind of have to figure everything out through consensus, through, you know, collaboration. It's really hard to get 10 people anywhere to like,
yeah. And it could potentially be a team that may not gel that well together.
Yeah,
like, how do
exactly.
You know,
I know. So it was really, really hard, because you know, it's just a lot of personalities and there's no clear leadership or assignment, and you're all just young people just trying to make something good in the limited amount of time you have. So anyway, it was already a hard year, and so that summer too was when a student started applying for internships. And I was determined to get a good internship. I remember thinking like, okay, this year is turning out really shitty, but if I could just like put everything into my portfolio and try to get a good internship, it'll make everything worthwhile.
Yeah.
And I remember I like tried really, really hard. I like built my portfolio up. I put all of what I thought were my best pieces in there based on like my school assignments. And then I applied and I waited, and I didn't end up getting any internships that summer. Yeah, and it really sucked.
After all the hard work.
Yeah, you know, like you work so hard. And then it's sucky because you like see your friends going off to like cool studios, like someone abroad to LA or London, and then you're kind of at school during the summer because they have an internship program at school for the quote-unquote leftovers.
The leftovers. Oh, that's nice they have that though, just in case.
Yeah,
safety net sort of thing.
I know, and I was there with some other students who didn't get internships that year either, and it was still a fun summer, but I was super bummed that nothing really worked out. And so then my dad was like let's go on a trip to China. Let's get your mind off of this. Let's you know, figure, let's just like relax. And we went on this like really funny, weird father-daughter trip through China that my dad planned himself. So he like booked the strangest tours.
It sounds really fun.
Yeah, it was really fun. I think thinking back, it was really funny because we, like, I don't know where he found some of these tours. Like, they were, some of them felt like very, like, touristy, scammy areas, but we had, yeah, I mean, I had a lot of fun regardless. And then I just remember.
That can about, I can see a film coming from that. Just pair.
I know.
Maybe.
It's really funny. Actually, it's funny because, well, I'll talk about it later. But
sure.
Yeah, so then I, you know, had that whole summer to kind of reflect. I looked at my portfolio again, and then I kind of realized, like, as I was looking through it, I was like, you know, I don't know if I would also pick me as well. Like,
oh.
When I looked at the portfolio, I mean, having enough distance from it, like, at first when I got rejected from Pixar and all these other places, I was like, oh my god, like, I was so mad and sad. But then when I thought about it and I like looked through it again, I realized like, oh, like I feel like all the pieces I chose and my mentality going into applying for internships was very much almost like fear-based or pressure-based, and very much I gotta put in the best pieces. I gotta figure out what they wanna see. And so I gotta put everything that I think might make me a desirable candidate in my portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
Versus a portfolio really is supposed to kind of represent who you are. Because there's so many applicants, you know, who are applying to all of these studios, and everyone can draw amazingly in their own way. But I think what makes you stand out, especially at a place like Pixar, is they want to hear your voice, and they want to see like who you are as a filmmaker and storyteller, your taste, your aesthetics, your point of view. Mm. And I felt, even though I had pieces in there that showed off my drawing skills and that, you know, I could draw an anatomically correct human body and stuff like that, I don't think those things that I put in there really reflected who I was as a storyteller. So I took the L, and then the next year...
The L? I don't know what that...
Sorry. It's the term. I took the loss.
Okay. I thought before this, I was like, she's probably going to say some things that I like are more American or Toronto or even Chinese, so you might have to explain to me. And I'm Scottish as well, so I might have to, if you need me to repeat something.
All good. Yeah, if I'm using, like, strange terminology, please point it out. I'm too chronically online sometimes. So then I looked at my portfolio again, and I redid my whole portfolio the next year while I was also working on my student film, which was a whole other thing too. But I, you know, just kind of with that in mind of just like, you know, don't just try to do work to get the grade or to impress others or to do what you think other people are going to respond to or react to. Like, you have to put yourself in there as well. And I think that's kind of a lesson that I really took with me throughout my career, just kind of making sure that whatever I'm doing, I'm kind of always infusing myself and my point of view in my work.
Yeah. I think it's the old age thing with any job, really. It's like, you do have to make yourself stand out, I guess, in the best way possible, because there's always going to be so many, especially for the best jobs, you know, there's going to be so many other amazing candidates. You've really got to stand out somehow.
Yeah, and also just, it's always like a mix, right, of, what is it, work, talent, and luck. Sometimes it's just timing and luck as well, because actually thinking back, if I did make it to that internship that first year I applied, I wouldn't have been hired, because that year they weren't hiring at Pixar. It just, you know, just because they just weren't hiring that year. So
yeah, timing is definitely a thing.
Yeah, it's timing. It's everything.
Can you walk me through then a little bit your early days when you finally got into Pixar and working as a storyboard artist and eventually going on to doing what you do now?
Yeah, like I mentioned, I applied a second time to the Pixar internship for storyboarding, and I got it in the year 2011. And that was my first time, you know, living outside of Canada, living in America. Yeah, I just, you know, I felt like kind of like a fish out of water a little bit, but in the best way. I felt like I learned so much during those 3 months during the Pixar internship. I loved animation, I loved anime, I loved comics and manga, but I never really knew anything about film in general until I came to Pixar. Like, I wasn't like a cinephile. I didn't watch Kurosawa movies or Scorsese or, you know, Spielberg as obsessively as some of the other people at the studio, but I really felt like I went to filmmaking boot camp when I arrived, and it was kind of scary and intimidating at first, but then I just learned so much. And now, yes, I'm a total cinephile as well as an anime nerd.
Amazing.
And yeah, I think the internship just really helped prepare me for the job in general, because it was very much like, you get a storyboarding assignment on Monday, and then you work like hell for the whole week, and then pitch it to a room full of people on Friday.
No pressure.
No pressure at all. It was terrifying. Whole all-nighters. This was back in the day when we had to draw storyboards by hand, too, like on paper, and we would pin it up, and we have to, like, use those sticks and, like, pitch it in person in front of everybody. Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh, it was so terrifying.
I mean, yeah, going from being in college, and then, yeah, of course, you did have a bit of a gap there until you eventually got into Pixar. But, yeah, I don't know, I can imagine it, like you say, being a fish out of water, but also, yeah, intimidating. But did you feel like what you'd done at school had prepared you? You're like, I feel confident being in a place like this. Like, I feel like I'm made to be here, kind of thing.
Yes and no. I feel like school and college gave me the technical chops, but nothing prepared me for the social aspect.
I mean, yeah, how many people work at Pixar? I don't know if you know.
Now it's like 1,300, but also being a storyboard artist, you have to, it's a lot of it is pitch teaching. A lot of it is verbally communicating ideas as well as drawing, at least at Pixar. Like,
so you've got to be a confident speaker without, I wouldn't have thought that job.
You have to like put up your storyboards and then you're doing all the voices, you know, if you were pitching like a Toy Story scene, you're like, Woody, like jumps out of Andy's car, lands on the ground, tumbled.
You've got to be a good actor then as well.
And you have to like do all the sound effects and everything.
Oh my god.
I was so bad at it. And I remember the feedback I got from my mentors like the first couple weeks during the internship was like, you have to work on your pitching.
I just assumed that like...
You're too like scared and you're too slow and like methodical and you just have to like be a storyteller.
Oh yeah, you need to be animated basically to be an animator. I just thought you could hide behind like your, you know, your drawing thing and your drawing pad or your computer and be like, I'm just going to...
Unfortunately, no. And especially, you know, as you move up and of course when you become a director, you can't...
Oh no, you can't be shy for that.
So I just had to get comfortable with not hiding behind my drawings anymore. But that was something that I realized I did for almost my entire life. You know, like when you're posting online, you can hide behind an anonymous username. But as a storyboard artist in the professional industry, like you have to learn how to do that one-on-one communicating, pitching. You're working directly with the director and the writer. You're in a lot of these like brainstorm meetings and rooms with people, and you have to know how to collaborate and work with people.
Yeah, you've got to sell your story as well.
Yeah, but it's also just a very collaborative medium, like animation. It just requires so many people to kind of like be on the same page and work together to get something done. It's not like writing a novel or like even a short film where the crew is much smaller and there's more like ownership but less hands on the work at an animation studio. You just have to get comfortable with working with a lot of people.
The question I wanted to ask, I've lost my thread there. It's actually a question from my dad, and I don't want to forget it, so I'm going to ask it now. And it was a bit of a nerdy question on his part. My dad's in his 70s, so his idea of animation is slightly different, and I know you're probably too young for this as well. But he was wondering if you started out with film animation, or was it straight to computer graphics? And I think what he means is drawing on film. I'm not sure if that's what he meant, but anyway...
started with 2D animation, you know, like the way that The Little Mermaid or Lion King were animated, right? Like,
possibly, not sure.
Paper, which is yes. So at school, I learned how to 2D animate. So I don't know if you've ever seen those like behind the scenes making like those like old 90s Disney cartoons and stuff. Like animators would draw on paper on their desks, and there'd be like a light that would shine through the table where you could see like through the pages, and they would draw each frame by hand.
Wow.
And they would like flip, you know, through.
Yeah, like a flip book kind of thing.
Yeah, kind almost. Of like a flip book. So I learned how to do that in school, but then when I transitioned to storyboarding, I haven't animated really since. But for my job as a director, I work directly with animators, and at Pixar, we do like all of our animation on the computer. Yeah.
Okay.
But the principles of animation are the same across mediums. So whether it's 2D hand-drawn animation or stop-motion animation, Wallace and Gromit.
Yeah. Love Wallace and Gromit.
I know. Or 3D animation. The principles of it are kind of the same, where, yeah, it's kind of just a way to express how a character is thinking and feeling through movement, through creating movement in a character design and stuff.
Okay, well, my dad will be happy that you answered that question of his. I mean, yeah, so you transitioned, I guess, quite easily from intern to full-time employee. Did that come about quite naturally, just got offered the job?
Yeah, I mean, again, a lot of it is timing, and it just so happened that summer they were hiring storyboard artists to staff up their projects, Monsters University and Inside Out. So I was hired as a storyboard artist on the first Inside Out film.
Amazing film.
I know, it was...
I still haven't seen the second, but... So
oh, yeah, it's really fun. I can't believe they made a second one. I can't believe it's been 10 years since the first one.
Has it? Oh, God, now I feel really old.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I felt again, you know, I thought a lot of it was timing. When I was pitching my internship assignment 1 week that summer, it just so happened that Josh Cooley, who was the head of story on Inside Out, like sat in on one of my pitches, and then he was the one that eventually ended up hiring me as a storyboard artist on Inside Out. So I owe a lot to him for just randomly deciding to sit in on an internship pitch.
Amazing. I'm sure it wasn't random. Fate collided.
I'm sure it was fate. I'm sure it was a bunch of things as well. But also, you know, it was interesting because there were not a lot of female storyboard artists on the movie as well. So I think they were feeling like they needed that perspective. And it is kind of, the stars kind of aligned.
Yeah. I'd love to talk about your first short film, Bao, which I watched for the first time recently, of course, in preparation for this interview, and I just fell in love with it. Such a simple yet emotional and beautiful story, and I just love the animation as well. It's beautiful. I'm actually looking online on Etsy how I can find a poster of the dumpling to put in my kitchen. I think it's so pretty. And it, you know, it centres on a Chinese mother's experience, but I think it's also universal, and it resonates with like a universal audience as well. But yeah, not only that, I mean, it got you an Oscar for Best Animated Short alongside your producer, Becky Naiman Cobb, which is very well deserved and just amazing. I'm sure that must have been like an amazing moment for you. And I'm wondering, after winning, how did your life and career change? Did it present new opportunities or any added pressure because you'd got this big prize?
Yeah. I mean, it is a huge bar to set for yourself when the first thing that you direct ends up winning.
Yeah. It's like, it can only go down from here. No, I'm joking, obviously.
I know. I think that's what was haunting me, like, afterwards. It's like, everything is going to be downhill from here. And I should have paced myself in some way. But no, I mean, you know, like, after making Bao, I think I proved to myself and to the studio, I think, that I could lead a team and kind of execute a vision from start to finish. So they tapped me to develop some ideas for feature films after Bao, and one of them ended up getting greenlit and turning red. I feel really grateful for being able to work on a short film, and I think for any aspiring filmmakers, I think working on short films is such a great way to gain that experience. Mm-hmm. And that training to like see a project through from beginning to end is like forcing you to kind of see the big picture of a story, and it's like lower stakes because it's not like a huge budget thing, and you get to like make mistakes and try stuff and figure out what your voice is as a filmmaker and as a storyteller. I feel like I wouldn't have been able to jump immediately into directing a feature if I had not directed a short.
Yeah, it's a good sort of testing ground, or whatever they call it. Yeah, like a learning ground for going on to something bigger. I've also introduced it to some family and friends since watching it, just so I can watch it again. And I'm just like, I love seeing their faces watching it, like, oh, it's just such a lovely film. And I was reading about the fact that one of your first animated web comic series was called My Food Fantasies. And then you also mentioned in, I think, another documentary or a video on YouTube that I watched, that Ratatouille was a big inspiration for creating this sort of hyper-realistic, sort of delicious, mouth-watering kind of food that you can see in Bao. And yeah, I was just wondering what else inspired your choices for food in the film and just your overall love of food.
Yeah, I love food. I'm really huge foodie.
And, that's the quote, I love food.
I love food, yeah. And I love drawing food at the time, too. I really just wanted, you know, it was kind of just a way to, like, at the time, you know, my day job was storyboarding at Pixar. But then I wanted, and I felt like I needed, like, a creative outlet to work on stuff and draw stuff that I wanted to draw. And at the time, it was, like, food and cute things and cute old people.
I have to say, the Bao was very, very cute. It was so cute.
Yeah. It kind of started off as this creative outlet. I was also kind of, you know, maybe somewhat processing my own kind of feelings of guilt of leaving my parents and that empty nest feeling that they might be having. So Bao started off as kind of this outlet, and then it kind of turned into something bigger than that. But yeah, I mean, I always have loved food, so So it was so great to be able to infuse that love of food into the film. And in a lot of cultures too, especially Chinese culture, like food is a love language. There's always this joke that like, oh, Asian parents don't say I love you, they say have you eaten yet. That was the case for, you know, the mom character in Bao, and I kind of wanted to celebrate this language of love. So it wasn't just like food porn, it was also just like a way, like this universal way that families and parents show their love for their children, even if they don't necessarily say it.
We'll be right back after a very quick break, as this is a bit of a long episode, so why not take this time to go get yourself a drink, or go to the toilet, or go and follow at Real Girls Club on Instagram, because that would be great. Thank you so much. Another thing I really loved in Bao was the music. It reminded me of my own travels in China, actually, and I thought it really set the scene and the tone of the movie. And I was wondering if you could tell me a bit more about your music choices for that film.
Yeah, so we got an amazing composer to do the music. His name was Toby Chu. And I remember when we first brought him the short, my inspiration was just wanting something kind of simple, because the whole world of Bao was very simple and round and warm and sweet. I didn't want like a full-blown orchestra. I didn't want like big sweeping, you know, songs or anything like that. I wanted it just to feel as intimate as the story was. And the inspiration I gave him was Miyazaki films like Totoro, but also the opening montage for Up, which had such a...
No, I can't remember it right now, but...
Yeah, it's very like... like, it was like a waltz, basically. It's very iconic, and you probably hear it all the time now. But yeah, and then he came back with this idea of like, what if we did like a Chinese waltz, which felt like a really cool combination of like Eastern and Western influences, because the story itself, Bao, it's not super clear in the story, but it takes place in Toronto. Like the house is actually based off of my parents' house.
Oh, it's lovely. Toronto. It was like a present to them, almost, sort of a, a gift in film form.
It is. And it was, since it was about this little immigrant old lady who made a dumpling, it felt right that the music would be a combination of Eastern and Western influences too. And I wanted it to feel like very melodic, like there was this like very clear melody that you'd kind of repeat throughout the movie in different ways. It'd be the same kind of melody when she's happy, but then also like slower and sadder towards the end.
Yeah, and it ends in a nice sort of really nice rounded happy way, I think.
It did. And it was just so interesting. It's so subtle in the score, but like Toby started the score with mostly Chinese instruments. But then by the end, just to show how the mom kind of opened herself up to, you know, accepting her son and his new girlfriend, it's a mixture of Chinese and Western instruments at the end.
Oh, okay. Because he'd married with a Western woman.
Yeah. But yeah. It also just shows like her world became bigger, became richer. It starts like smaller and then it kind of ends bigger. Yeah.
I like that. Sorry, my computer was having a bit of a meltdown. Hopefully it's working now. Okay, great. We're back again. So I'd love to go on and talk about now. I'd love to talk about your film Turning Red. It's such an amazing film, a proper explosion of colour and fun and joy and emotion. And I really wish it existed when I was growing up, because I just think it would have, I don't know, made me feel so much more understood in so many ways. But I'm grateful it exists now and for current and future generations to come. And you also became one of few to have directed a film at Pixar with that film. And it's a film that tackles, you know, coming of age and generational conflict and also cultural identity. How did you manage to sort of balance complex themes in a way that resonated with such a broad audience?
Yeah. You know, I think the seed of any great movie kind of starts with a personal feeling or emotion or memory, and kind of building on that. And for me, it was just viscerally remembering when I was around that age, just waking up one day and being like, what the heck happened to my body overnight? I smell weird, I'm covered in hair, I'm hungry, I'm horny, I'm angry, like I have like crazy mood swings. And I just wanted to explore what that would be like in animated form. And that was kind of the emotion, an idea that kind of inspired the rest of Turning Red. And of course, being a fan of anime, I think that was also a huge inspiration for this film, was trying to, like, the way I always pitched it to the crew, like, the vibe and tone was, like we're trying to do, like, an Asian tween fever dream.
Okay.
With the colors, with the energy, with our main character, May, and how she, like, looks and acts and how she, feels. And this is a story about just how she's dealing with growing up and growing apart from her mom, which is, on one hand, a very personal to me, but also something very universal that a lot of people go through, is like that feeling of when you go from kid to adolescent and you're realizing that you're not just your parents' kind of mini me anymore, that you're starting to like things and go into a world that is different from them, and wrestling with that feeling. And I think I've seen where, the kid is like antagonistic and they're like fighting against their parents to break free, but I felt like I wanted to explore that feeling that I related to more, which was this sense of guilt of like not wanting to separate from my mom and my parents, but realizing that I had to. So it was kind of exploring that bittersweet emotion of growing up, of not just like, I can't wait to be independent and be on my own. Mm. But it's more like, oh, like I want this, but I also want to.
Yeah, torn between
parents forever as well. So that was also the emotion that I wanted to explore.
You can definitely see a theme there through Bao and Turning Red then, with a similar kind of story. I mean, what do you think, I find that representation on screen is so powerful, especially when you're growing up. And I was wondering if Domi, as a little kid, could see Turning Red, what would she think of it?
Oh, yeah, I feel like I made it for her, for that tween in me, and for tweens everywhere who are going through all of this. And I hope that, the film just kind of tells them that growing up is messy and you're not going to figure it all out, and that's okay. And it's going to be exciting and thrilling, but also a little bit sad as well. And that's okay too. It's just, I hope the film just shows her and shows everyone that like all of this stuff you're feeling and going through is totally normal, even though it totally doesn't feel normal and it's scary and crazy and embarrassing. Like, everyone goes through this, and you will be okay.
Yeah, you'll come out alive. You'll be fine. I mean, what was the feedback like when the film came out? I don't know if you get fan mail or how you get response from people. I mean, I don't know if you get messages or what kind of.
The feedback and the response has been amazing. Like, little girls and guys coming up to me being like, oh my gosh, I wish I had this movie when I was like a tween.
Yeah.
or like I love May, I love just how like spunky and dorky and cringy she is. And so many people relate so much to the main character or relate to the mom character. I feel like a lot of people also just really appreciated the like seeing the family dynamic too in the movie, like with the grandma and the aunties, and how even though they're kind of over the top and judgy, that they truly do love their family, and they'll throw everything down in order to help a family member out. The response has been truly like amazing.
I mean, animation, I think, is so obviously it's technically more aimed at children, but I think also our inner child can still appreciate it. I mean, I watched Turning Red a couple of years ago and I was 27 or 28, I'm not sure, and I still thought I love this. I loved also watching the Embrace the Panda documentary about the making of Turning Red, and I also especially appreciated that the creative team was mostly female led and some were also mums and mums to be. I'm wondering how this influenced the storytelling and the emotions of the film, especially when you're exploring themes like adolescence and also mother daughter relationships.
Yeah, I think it was super vital to have mothers kind of on the crew and involved in the creative process, because I feel like because I'm not a mom, I'm coming at the story from the perspective of May, the main character. So I feel like if it was just coming from my perspective, the film would kind of skew very much just one way, like from the perspective of a tween. But I think because we have such an amazing creative team of, you know, writers, producers, production designers, new moms, older moms, I think they really helped round out the mother character, Ming, as well. And I think when you watch the movie, you know, she's such a character, right? Like she kind of, she's so protective of her daughter. She loves her daughter. She'll like chew out anybody who she...
Yeah, you don't want to mess with her.
You don't want to mess with her. But I think we always wanted to like inform her character from a place of like, all she wants to do is to protect her daughter. Maybe she'll go about it the wrong way or be a little bit too over the top about it, but we always wanted to like understand her and you know why she is the way that she is, and a lot of her kind of backstory with, you know, her own kind of panda and her own mother and the aunties too, like that I think developed over time. Like that wasn't always there when I initially pitched the idea, so all of that was kind of added to kind of give her more depth and understanding, and then you kind of really feel that satisfying feeling at the end when May and Ming come together, because mm-hmm. it's not just them making up, it's like May realizing a big part of her growing up is realizing that her mom is human too. Like her mom isn't a goddess like she thought in the beginning of the movie, or a monster like she thought in the middle of the movie, but her mom is human mm-hmm. and flawed and imperfect like she is, and that yeah, and that they could truly bond after that moment.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. Back to your sort of role as a director on that film, would you say you have a certain leadership style? I mean, I noticed in the documentary, I think it was in the documentary that you said this, that you said it took you a while to feel comfortable in the room. And I was wondering when the turning point was for you, when you thought, I can use my voice and feel confident in using it.
Oh, I mean, I always feel a little bit uncomfortable when I'm directing.
That's reassuring.
But I think it's just real. It's just getting comfortable with being uncomfortable. I think that's kind of the trick to it. You know, in the beginning, when you're tasked with this huge, like, responsibility to lead a project, you don't want to make any mistakes and you want to appear like you know what you're doing and saying. But then you slowly realize, like, no one really knows what they're doing. And your job as a director isn't to have all the answers. Your job as a director is to be able to communicate with others, to get other people excited about this vision, mm-hmm. and to not to have all the answers, but to be able to work with others to find the answers together. Mm-hmm. That's the key. And then also just like being calm and level-headed when things blow up and when unexpected things happen, which do happen all the time. For us, it was the pandemic,
yeah.
which was pretty crazy, having to continue working on this project while everyone just kind of moved all of their equipment to their homes.
Yeah,
their,
the majority of that film was made in the pandemic, wasn't it? About two.
Yeah, majority of it was made there, so it took a lot. Yeah, like you just have to learn to adapt and just be comfortable being uncomfortable.
That's a good one. I like that. You also mentioned in the documentary about a female collective called the Story Artistas. Could you tell me about this in a nutshell?
Yeah.
What that's
yeah.
about?
So a couple of the female producers and execs on the at Pixar at the time, it was Mary Coleman and Nicole Grindel. They really were incentivized, like they wanted to, you know, help grow female creative leadership at the studio. So they just kind of started having these lunches with and inviting all the female story artists to these lunches. And at the time, there was only about five of us in like a department of like 40. So we all kind of got lunch together like once a month with the, I mean, at first it kind of just started off as a way to kind of get to know each other, vent and validate each other, and you know, just to gather in a group and share stories and just, you know, feel like you're not alone when you say something stupid in a meeting and then you're like, why did I say that? Why the fuck did I say that? Like, it's just so, like, you, it's just so nice to hear other people feeling that way too.
Realize you're all sort of feeling the
And
same things.
and in those groups, you get to kind of be more comfortable in those groups. It's smaller. You all kind of come from a similar place in terms of being kind of the only female in a room sometimes. And then you kind of get to, for me, I grew a bit of my confidence in those lunches. And it helps so much when it's low pressure and you're all just in there. And I think that was like one of the first times where I actually like verbalized what I wanted to be. Like, I remember it was a little bit of a hokey exercise that we did where we each said out loud what we wanted, what our goal was. I want to do this, or I want to do this. And then I said out loud, like, I want to direct.
It just came out of you, burst out.
Yeah, I was like, I want to direct. And then I kind of made a weird, like, grin face. And
You're like,
then
that wasn't me.
everyone
I didn't
was
say that.
like, yeah, but it sounded weird to say out loud. And then I realized at the time, I was like, why is this so weird for me to say that out loud, that I want to do something? And then I don't know, it just helped so much with just me realizing that, yeah, it's not like a crazy idea that I can actually be something that's possible to do. And I don't have to make a weird face.
But yeah, I mean, I can imagine though saying something that maybe at the time might feel, or maybe to your even younger self when you were just starting out, might seem like such a far-fetched dream, you know, maybe to do something like that. But yeah, maybe some, I've talked about this a lot with my other podcast guests, and they talk a lot about imposter syndrome, which is like the words of the
Yes.
moment. So maybe it was a bit of that.
We all had imposter syndrome at the time. I still kind of do sometimes as well, but again, it's just something that you just live with and you manage. But also just like, it's just nice to have a group of people, like a support system. And you don't realize that like a lot of people who get to where they are, they don't get there on their own. They have people around them, allies, friends, coworkers, and they
Mentors
all have
and
other mentors, and they help each other out. Like, it's not something you have to kind of grind on your own, because there are all these stories about, like, yeah, the
self-made
guy,
kind of thing.
self-made. He was in his basement. He was working on this amazing invention, and then he crawled his way to the top of the ladder all by himself. That is not the case at all. That's like a fantasy. And it's just, I feel like it's so much more rewarding and better and more realistic just to to have a group. And I feel like success and growth can only really happen with other people around you.
And that's great. It was like women supporting women, you know, not competition. It was actually lifting each other up, which is really nice. And it should be more normalized, I guess. Okay, I'm going to try and zoom through my last few questions. I really want to try and fit in as many as I can. So, you mentioned there are some challenges, sorry, having challenges or like when stress comes about. I was wondering what kind of challenges you maybe have. And another sort of to add to that question, you mentioned it took 2 months to perfect the shape of the dumplings for Bao. What other things would someone be surprised to know takes very long to do an animation and challenges alongside that?
I'll answer the second one first because I guess it's a little shorter. What's hard to do in animation? Well, what's hard to do in 3D animation? Food is hard because it's organic, it's soft. Explosions, easy. A building collapsing, easy. But like, what was super hard, like technically hard, was like that shot in Bao where the mom is folding the dumpling and kind of
Yeah, it's
squeezing it
very
in.
detailed and
That was like, we called it our money shot because it was so
is
expensive.
beautiful. It's a great shot.
Yeah, anything that involves like characters touching and molding and grabbing something that kind of is soft and kind of forms around them. Like, if you want to animate someone's like shirt getting grabbed, very expensive to do. Hair, like hand, like running through hair,
It's so it's
because
the
it's like,
finer things, like when it's really detailed and natural and organic, as you say.
Like tactile, detail, organic, anything like soft and that involves a lot of touch or molding. But yeah, fire, like explosives, all that kind of stuff.
So they're the cheaper films to make.
Like car crashes, things that look like, whoa, that looks really impressive and flashy. You'd be surprised that on Turning Red, what was really expensive and hard to do was backpacks.
Oh, interesting.
Because like characters have to w wear the backpacks, and there's a lot of like contact with the backpack and their hair. If like would they have touch the backpack, and if so, how does the hair behave when it touches the backpack? There's a lot of, like, you know,
zips and the
dangle from that. There's a lot of math and physics involved that you don't even, like, realize.
And you take I'll think about that next time I watch the film. I'll be like, that backpack took so long to do.
Well, now if you watch movies or you play video games, you'll see sometimes animators cheat. Like, it's hard to show a character taking off, like, a shirt, but then sometimes the movie will just cut away and then cut back and the character will be in a whole new outfit or something. Or on Turning Red, when May hides under her blanket, when she turns into a red panda and she's all, like, scared, that was really expensive to do.
And probably the hair on the panda as well must have been...
Yeah, the hair on the panda, but also, like, a blanket over the hair is really hard to do, because that's, like, that blanket needs to be simulated, the hair needs to be simulated, and you just got to figure out the physics of hair against blanket being tugged by hand.
So many hours of work, and just imagine being at the computer as well doing that. You've got to be so focused and just patient as well, I imagine.
Brilliant team of math geniuses, which is what we have.
Definitely. You've got a film coming out in 2025 called Elio. I've watched the trailer for it, so I have a rough idea what it's about, but I'd love you to tell me a bit more what it's about and what to expect. Because it's, you know, different in this case from Turning Red, because it's, you know, Turning Red focuses on a young girl's experience, whereas Elio is about a boy. And I was wondering how your approach to storytelling changed, if at all, when focusing on a boy's journey, and what excites you about this film, Elio?
Yeah, well, I'm coming on a little later into this project, and it's the first time that I'm kind of jumping on as a co-director for a project that's already kind of started. I'm really excited about it. I think what I identify a lot with this character is, like, his... I mean, it's just a story about that universal feeling of loneliness and feeling like, am I the only one out here? Is there anybody in this universe who wants me? And I remember just feeling that way for, like, many points in my life, like being an only child and feeling this sense of envy for all my friends who have siblings, but also, like, in high school and not having a boyfriend and seeing all my classmates pair up and you know, just that feeling again. It's like going back to that one emotion that we can all kind of relate to or understand, because we've all kind of been there. I think that's kind of what's been our guiding light as we navigate this film. And yeah, it's my first time dabbling in sci-fi as well, which is really exciting, because it's, yeah, the universe is just so, like, mind-blowing and expansive, but also there's also this sense of loneliness out there as well. So it's like both, like, space is both, like, really inviting and, like, fantastical, but also kind of lonely and terrifying, and I kind of love that contrast of both. So I'm excited to be exploring that more.
So you can still really bring your perspective to a boy's story. I mean, as you say, it's universal, what he's feeling.
I think his emotions are pretty universal, even though he's, like, a boy specifically.
I can't wait to take my nephews to see it. They're 6 and 3, and I showed them The Incredibles recently, and they were like, that was so good. I mean, one of them was a little bit scared, actually, at some points, but, you know, I suppose there are some scary elements in The Incredibles for a kid. Sorry?
Sometimes it's okay to be scared.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, yeah, natural part of growing up and everything. And you're also working on another feature, but this one is more personal. I couldn't find a name for the film, so I guess maybe there isn't one yet.
It's pretty early on. Yeah, it's pretty early on. I can't say too much about it, but yeah, I'm in development on that as well.
Okay, so you can't say too much. I won't ask any more then, I guess. Last few questions. I think the last one you'll be able to answer quite quickly, hopefully. So the last question is, what advice would you give to young women who are interested in pursuing a career in animation or filmmaking, or who would like to even work at Pixar one day?
I would say just keep developing your voice as a storyteller. If it's drawing that you do, like, keep doing that. If it's writing, keep doing that. Just keep making stuff and always try to feed that creative fire that's in you to make stuff. And I think you just learn so much just from doing, and just keep doing that. And also find your community, find your allies, find your people who will support you, but also give you that real and critical feedback that you need in order to grow. Find people who will support you, but also push you.
Okay, good one. And the last one, you said you're a big foodie. Other than dumplings, what is your absolute favorite Chinese dish and why? I thought it'd be quite interesting, because I love Chinese food. When I was there, I loved all the food there. So
yeah, favorite Chinese food? Oh, that's so hard because there's so many good ones.
I agree. So many good things.
I think like I really have a nostalgia for stir-fried tomato and egg.
Yes, I
This is
tried
like
that.
a very classic comfort food in China, and my dad makes it for me all the time when I go back and visit him, and you just have it over rice, and it's really simple. It's just literally tomatoes, scrambled eggs, green onion, and soy sauce, and you just eat it over rice,
It
and
sounds
it's
so
like a
good. I think I actually tried that when I was in China, amongst many other things.
yeah, it's super tasty.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I could talk to you for hours about your job and animation. It's just so interesting. I hope you do your own podcast or documentary or something. I don't know, because I need to hear more. Anyway, thank you so much and have a lovely day.
Yeah, you too.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. I hope you loved it as much as I enjoyed making it. It was fascinating for me to learn a bit more about Domi's career at Pixar, who for me are one of the best animation studios and have made some of my favourite childhood films. I'd love it if you could please subscribe and rate this podcast and share the episode to anyone you think will love it too. You can follow the podcast at Real Girls Club on Instagram for future updates and also other fun content as well. I'll be back very soon for a BFI London Film Festival bonus episode. Until then, have a lovely day.